I'm David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I talk to on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. We are continuing with our mini-series that we started a few weeks ago with the episode titled Fire Your Business Coach. We're talking about why so many professionals today seem to be floundering, why they're looking for answers in all the wrong places. We offer some tips about what they should be doing instead. This week, we're looking at the myths behind the individual genius, that all-powerful leader who seems to have reached great achievements, and many of us think we should be able to do the same standing on our own two feet. Our discussion may raise some questions in your mind. I really want to hear from you. Connect with me on LinkedIn and Twitter, or leave me a message on my personal phone number, 646-216-9306. If you like what you hear, please share this episode with your colleagues and friends, and it would mean a great deal to us if you would leave a review on iTunes to help others find our show. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Vivek Tiwari. Vivek is a number one New York Times best-selling author. He's a Tony Award-winning Broadway producer and founder of the multi-platform arts and entertainment company Tiwari Entertainment Group. Vivek's graphic novel, The Fifth Beatle, The Brian Epstein Story, based on the untold life story of Beatles manager Brian Epstein, has won a number of prestigious literary awards. The Fifth Beatle is now being adapted into a feature film that has secured unprecedented access to Beatles music. Vivek is writing its screenplay and will serve as a producer. On Broadway, Vivek's productions have won a combined 25 Tony Awards and over 44 Tony nominations. Vivek is just a very distinguished guest. I'm so pleased to have Vivek back again as a guest on Smashing the Plateau. Vivek, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
So Vivek, I'm a huge admirer of your work and your accomplishments. And I know that you have spent a good part of your career studying another very accomplished professional. But before we get into those details, I wonder if we can take a step back and look at the context of professional accomplishment and what's going on in the world today, and maybe discuss some myths and realities about what it takes to become accomplished. One of the things that I've noticed is that there seem to be so many professionals that are floundering in the 21st century. It seems to me that it's way more than it used to be. And on the other hand, there also seem to be so many more gurus and experts out there who are willing to help. So why is it that professionals don't get the help they need? What are your thoughts?
You know, it's a tough question for me to answer because I feel like for the most part, I'm getting the help that I need, and I can only really speak to my own experience. But I would guess that a large part of the reason why professionals aren't getting the help that they need is they're not asking for it. You know, there are a lot of resources out there, and part of the challenge is, you know, filtering through which are actually useful and legitimate and which are not. But I think that, you know, professionals, entrepreneurs especially, you know, it can be difficult to ask for help, either because you're so wrapped up in your own world or part of being a successful professional is being confident and being driven and not showing any weakness. You know, it can be a little bit humbling to take that step back and say, I need some help, either because you're overwhelmed or you don't understand a particular aspect of the business, or maybe it's spilling over into your personal life and you need help juggling work with personal. You know, these are all sensitive things that professionals may not like to admit their weakness on. If I had to speculate, I think it would be just the part of the big problem is professionals not asking for help.
Look, I don't know about you, but I can tell you, for me personally, I find asking for help, especially when it's something where I'm stuck, I find asking for help is a very humbling process. And you know, it's kind of ironic. professionally, I'm in a helping role. And you'd think that I would be really good at asking for help. And I don't know that I'm any better than anybody else. I think it's really hard to ask for help. I agree with you.
It is. You know, and for me, you know, I won't go off on too much of a tangent about my personal life. But, you know, I lost my parents at a very young age. And I was in my early 20s. And I'm an only child. And, you know, I found myself in a position where I really had no choice but to ask for help. You know, I really leaned on my friends and my family and my aunts and uncles and my cousins. And so I think, you know, from that experience, that very humbling, very desperate experience, to be very frank, that's when I learned the value of getting help and realizing that there's a lot of help around and a lot of more people out there who are willing to help and who really care about you than you might think. So I've sort of grown up sort of having been forced into a situation where I learned how to ask for help, but even so, it's difficult. You're absolutely right.
You know, I think that's actually very profound that desperation often forces us to ask for help where we might not do it otherwise.
Yeah.
And I wonder what your thoughts are about maybe the message that we get in our culture about trying to stand on our own two feet by relying on the resources that we already have, or maybe relying on personal development alone versus asking for help, you know, and maybe being in more of a community of support as opposed to kind of feeling like we have to go it alone.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a huge believer in community. You know, I come out of the theater world. I'm very pleased to have worked in a number of artistic disciplines, but my real background is Broadway, and you know, certainly where I've spent the largest part of my professional life has been producing on Broadway. And theater is almost by definition a collaborative experience. You know, when you are part of a company, you know, the word is company, and it's a well chosen word. You know, you have to rely on each other. And so I come out of that environment, and I'm at my happiest and my most successful when I'm part of a company, when I'm part of a team, part of a family, and everybody's supporting everybody and looking out for each other's backs. And yes, every person is fulfilling a specific role. So there is, you know, there is a individuality and specific tasks to be handled, but really everybody is also part of a larger machine.
Right. And that machine is designed to be supportive of one another.
Indeed.
Yeah, so you know, that's a very interesting observation. Now, I wonder if we can go back to what's going on from the side of the people who are in the helping roles. You know, I mentioned that there seem to be so many people who are claiming to be gurus and experts and are ready to help. Why do you think there seem to be these trends in the coaching industry?
You know, it's not, I'll be honest, I haven't used a coach in many, many years. I did use a coach some years back, but the coach that I used was considered a life coach. So it wasn't just for business. There was quite a bit of business discussions in our coaching, but it was also personal as well as business oriented. So it's been some time, so I can't claim to be totally up to speed with the trends in coaching. But I would guess that people in general that the world is at a place where people feel that they need some degree of help. And probably that's why a lot of people have stepped in to purport to fill that void. You know, I think that there is a certain degree of, without wanting to get too into global politics or anything like that, I think we are, we're at a place in the world where a lot of people are acting out of fear. I think there's a lot of fearfulness in the world right now. And I think when you are in a fear-based environment, you become somewhat, you know, as to use a word you and I just use without wanting to sound melodramatic, a little desperate. And in desperate times, people may need help, and those who are able to have the strength will ask for help. And so that's probably why there have been a buildup of people who are there to offer it, you know, whether it's legitimate or non-legitimate.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with you. I think that fear and desperation do feed into the phenomenon we're seeing with people who are offering to help. And some of them are really good. And then there are others that are maybe at best one step ahead of the people that they're trying to help.
Right.
Now, I know you've spent a lot of time around the concept of a historical mentor.
Yeah.
And why do you think a lot of executives and would-be executives would do better with a dead mentor than a living coach?
Right. Well, I don't know about do better. You know, I think that when it comes to living coaches, you just need to be very careful with, to do your diligence. You know, it's just like any other business opportunity. If you're a business person, you know, you don't enter a partnership or you know, pick up a new client or take a job without doing diligence, right? I mean, any good businessman spends a lot, or businesswoman spends a lot of their time doing their diligence.
Right.
And it should be the same with picking a coach. You know, you should do your diligence, get references. Where have they been trained? What are their experiences? Who else have they coached? What are their accolades? You know, ask them tough questions. Ask them what they think are their failings. What are their greatest successes in coaching? And what are their greatest failures in coaching? And, you know, just do your diligence. It's just like hiring any other partner, really. And I suspect if more people did their diligence, they might find themselves with coaches that were more useful. I think part of the problem is just taking a lot of these coaches on face value or on website value, if you will, and not really digging into to making sure they actually have the backgrounds and the skills that they may claim to have. But you know, for me, this concept of a historical mentor really comes out of, again, you know, going back to, you know, it might be a little bit melodramatic to keep, say, desperation, but to a place of great need. You know, I found myself at the Wharton School of Business in 1991, and I was dreaming of a career in the arts and entertainment industries. Wharton is a wonderful school. I'm very fond of the school, and I as an alumni, I try to be very, very active. But to be very honest, in 1991, Wharton did not have a lot of resources for students who were interested in entering the arts and entertainment industries. That's changed, and I myself hope that I am one of those resources. I go back to the school as often as I can to guest lecture and to be a resource for the students who want to pursue those fields. But in 1991, I found myself a bit of a black sheep at the college, at the university. Most of my peers were heading towards fields like finance and accounting and investment banking. You know, they weren't interested in entering media and the arts. And so I was literally just unable to find a living, breathing mentor to guide me in my career path. And so I had no choice but to turn to the history. To history. You know, I said, if I'm not getting this from my classes and not getting it from the network that's around me, and my dream is to be an entrepreneur in the arts and entertainment industries, then I need to study the lives of the great arts and entertainment entrepreneurs and the great visionaries. And being a lifelong Beatles fan, I believe that the Beatles wrote and then rewrote the rules of pop music business with their manager, Brian Epstein. I thought I should study the life of Brian Epstein. He was the guy that discovered the band and brought them from humble beginnings as a rough and tumble Liverpool act and engineered Beatlemania and turned them into international pop culture icons. And I thought by studying Brian's life, I will find the sort of inspiration that I had been missing in as it particularly related to the arts and entertainment industries. And that's kind of how I dove into a study of Brian Epstein. And the stories I uncovered were incredibly inspiring. And they started with the business stories. You know, I wanted to know, how did he come up with the suits and haircuts? How did he get the Beatles a record deal when every single record label had passed on the band? You know, Ed Sullivan was not interested in booking the Beatles because a British band had never made an impact in the United States. How did Brian Epstein convince Ed Sullivan not just to book the band, but to make them headliners on the Ed Sullivan show? You know, these were the business stories that I was seeking. And I uncovered them, and they were incredibly inspiring. But as I began to uncover these stories about Brian's professional life, I also uncovered stories about his personal life. And I began to learn that he was gay and Jewish and from Liverpool. And in the 1960s, those were three significant obstacles. It's a felony to be gay. It's literally against the law. Anti-Semitism is prevalent in the country in a way that it isn't today. And moreover, Jews just did not work extensively in the music industry in the United Kingdom in the 1960s. That's obviously changed, but back then they weren't prevalent in the industry. And finally, Liverpool, prior to the Beatles, is a port town without any cultural significance. So I also learned that Brian Epstein was the ultimate outsider. He was a gay Jewish 26-year-old kid running around a dirty port town in the north of England saying he found a local rock and roll band who were going to elevate pop music into an art form, who were going to be bigger than Elvis. You know, people laughed at him. They thought he was crazy, and they thought that dream was crazy. They said, you know, that can't be done, and people like you don't do things like that. And ironically, even though I began chasing the business stories, and initially I just wanted a business mentor, you know, what I uncovered was this personal story that was the true heart of my inspiration. I felt if that gay Jewish kid from Liverpool could do it, you know, why couldn't a weird Indian kid from New York's Lower East Side decide that not to be a doctor or an engineer or go into technology, which are the kind of things that were expected of me as a young Indian kid. You know, I wanted to write comic books and produce Broadway musicals. You know, but so Brian Epstein's example showed me that the way I put it is that no dream was too impossible and no person too unlikely to realize that dream. And that's why he became what I call my historical mentor. You know, someone whose life I've studied incredibly meticulously as an example of what to do and what not to do. You know, I also believe that mentors, you learn from their successes, but also from their failings. You know, any good mentor is a human being who does some things right and some things wrong. And you learn from both of those things.
You sure do.
You know? And so that you know, and I always encourage people of all stripes, whether it's a young kid in high school just beginning to think about their future, or it's a top-level executive, that if you can't find a living, breathing mentor that's giving you all the things that you need, you know, go to the history books, go to the internet. It's so much easier now than when I began, you know, in 1991 when I began my study. There's no Wikipedia, there's no YouTube, there's no Google. You know, there are none of these resources we take for granted today. Today, it's so much easier to uncover information about figures from history. And the amount of inspiration there is right at our fingertips, just delving into the course of human history, is extreme. You know, I always tell people, you have no excuse to tell me you can't find a mentor, because at the very least, you can find yourself a historical mentor, you know? And if I can digress a little bit, I will say that the great thing about a historical mentor is that they're dead. You know, they can't tell you no. They can't not take your call or not agree to take a meeting with you or tell you they're too busy to take on a mentee. You know, they're right there. You know, and let me not be too disingenuous. Like, obviously, the difficult thing about a historical mentor is also that they're dead. You know, you have to spend a lot of time and effort and energy and passion researching these people's lives. But the experience is incredibly rewarding. And I really cannot recommend this concept higher to people, to go out there, figure out what it is that you are passionate about, and find a mentor from history to guide you in that path.
Well, Vivek, couldn't you also find somebody who is not dead, but that you don't speak to, and just do the same kind of meticulous research and follow that person?
Of course. And let me be very clear on this. I've been blessed in my career with a number of mentors. Brian Epstein is my historical mentor, but that's not to say that I also haven't had living, breathing mentors. You know, I've had mentors in every industry I've dabbled in. You know, who've taken me under their wing and taught me the ropes and I could lean on for advice. No question. I'm not suggesting that a historical mentor should replace a living, breathing, actual mentor. The luckiest situation is where you can have both. But my point is merely that if you're having trouble finding that living, breathing mentor, then you won't have trouble, so to speak, finding a historical mentor. It might take a lot of work, but as any successful business person will tell you, you know, the best things in your career always will. You know, nothing comes easy. The biggest successes and the best things take a lot of work. But please don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that a historical mentor should replace any living, breathing mentor. It's something that should complement the mentors that surround you day by day.
Yeah, so I want to actually pick up on something you said earlier about the theater community. And once you decided on what you were passionate about and the path you wanted to take, as you try to implement some of those things that you learned for yourself in your own career, how did being part of a supportive community or supportive communities help you along your own path?
I'm sorry, could you sort of just ask that one more time?
Sure. So you studied Brian Epstein,
yeah,
meticulously, and yeah, obviously learned a lot of lessons based on his story. As you determine what it is you are passionate about doing and you set the path in front of you, as you started to implement actions to lead you down that path, like with everybody else, I'm sure there were ups and downs.
Sure.
How did being part of a community, assuming that took place, because you talked earlier about being part of the theater and it's a supportive community, how did being part of a community or communities help you with the ups and downs, particularly the downs?
Well, I mean, it's you know, I don't know that it's a very complicated answer. It's just you need to ask for help. You know, you need to reach out to the people who've done the things that you want to do or are working in the spaces that you want to work and seek guidance. And really seeking guidance is a matter, in some ways, I would say it's not very different from accumulating data. You know, a lot of times the guidance that I sought from in theater, for example, from some of the people, the producers who are older than me and who've been like mentors to me, there were a number of times where those older, more accomplished producers and mentors told me that not to do something. They said, you know, that project that you want to do, it's difficult. It's, you know, I wouldn't recommend it. You should do something else. And I didn't take their advice. And then I still found myself with a lot of success. But I didn't just ignore their advice. I absorbed it and thought, okay, like, they're right. These are the things that are going to be difficult about this, and I'm going to need to spend extra time on this, or other people are going to react the way they did, and I need to be prepared to handle the naysayers. So, you know, a good mentor or a good advisor, or even somebody that's just providing any kind of assistance. There's assistance to be found when people are telling you to do things that you disagree with. You know, sometimes you do need to carve your own path. Any entrepreneur will tell you that. Trailblazing is a big part of it, but there's a lot to be said for intelligent trailblazing, if you will, and listening to the people who tell you no. Like, some of the best advice I've gotten is the advice that I didn't take.
Yeah. So how do you decide what advice to take and what advice not to take?
Well, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I feel like that really is your gut. You know, you just if there are people that you respect who are telling you to do things that and you just ultimately disagree with them, you have to be very clear that you know why you're doing that, you know, and you have to in your gut know that's the right thing. I mean, I don't have an easy answer to you on that. It's just a matter of doing your diligence. You know, if you're not going to take advice from somebody that you respect, make sure you have a damn good reason for not taking that advice. And that should be a mixture of having done your research and believing that person who is advising you is just wrong, and also having a gut. It's a mixture of the two, I guess.
Yeah. Are you willing to share a story that may exemplify how you didn't take somebody's advice?
Sure. I mean, I sort of have alluded to it already, you know, in a number of productions that I was working on, A Raisin in the Sun, for example. It was a Broadway revival of a classic piece of African-American literature. I was the producer on that show. And this is not, it was done recently with Denzel Washington, but I'm referring to the production a few years before that. It was the first revival where we cast Sean Combs, P. Diddy, as our male lead. And when I went about with this idea that we wanted to bring A Raisin in the Sun back to Broadway, and I ran it by, you know, a number of the producers that have been had been mentors to me over the years and had provided me with advice and guidance, and many of whom gave me my first break in the industry, without fail, they all told me not to do it. They said, you know, that's a difficult project that you're taking on. And they told me things like, you know, African-Americans don't come to Broadway. You know, it's very difficult to get kids to Broadway. You're going to lose your shirt. Sean Combs is not a draw on Broadway. The critics aren't going to like this show. You're crazy. You shouldn't be doing this. You should pick something that's simpler. And I didn't just like a rebel say, okay, well, I'm not going to pay any attention to that. I'm going to just do it anyway. You know, I believed in the show and I did decide to do it anyway. But I listened to everything that they said very carefully. And I thought, okay, you know, if African-Americans and kids aren't coming to Broadway, you know, I think it's ridiculous to say that they won't come to Broadway, but I should realize that, you know, these older producers, they must know something because they've been doing this for a while. So I need to pay extra careful attention to how am I going to get the African-Americans and the kids to come to Broadway? And I believed in my heart that you give them something they want to see and they'll come. But the second part of that is like, well, I guess I need to make sure that they know it's there, you know, and they may not be consuming the same kind of media that traditional Broadway audiences consume. So I believe that A Raisin in the Sun with Sean Combs, P. Diddy as our male lead, would be a show that African Americans and kids would want to see. But I needed to make sure that they knew it was there. So I needed to advertise in the papers that they were reading. Maybe they're not reading the New York Times theater reviews. And I needed to do radio promotion because maybe they're listening to hip hop stations and they're going to you know, music concerts. And so I hired street teams, which is a pretty commonplace thing to do now. But back then, you know, to talk to my Broadway colleagues about hiring a street team, people were like, what is a street team? You know, you're going to have kids go out and pass out flyers outside music concerts to promote your show. Like, people looked at me like I had three heads. They had no idea what I was talking about here. So I actually did listen to the advice, but I just incorporated it in a very different way than was intended, you know. And every single one of those producer colleagues, you know, and mentors came back to me and they said, "God bless you, Vivek. It's a good thing you didn't take my advice. You know, your show was really successful. It broke even in 7 weeks. It won a whole bunch of Tonys. It made good money. It was a successful show." And I like to think we were also at the forefront of marking a sea change on Broadway where, you know, a lot of African-Americans and kids are coming now. And I won't say that's because of A Raisin in the Sun, but I like, as I said, I like to think that we were part of being at the forefront of the vanguard that did usher that in. You know, and when those producers said, "It's a good thing you didn't take my advice," you know, I would often counter and say, "Well, I actually did take your advice, but just not in the way that you might have intended it. You know, I didn't not do the show, but I listened to everything you had to say very carefully, and I made sure that I was, if I was going to do this anyway, that I was going to still take into consideration and counter all the concerns you had."
It also sounds like their advice helped you understand where the obstacles might be and what and force you to think about alternatives.
Absolutely. And look, and then I faced the exact same thing of several years later when I wanted when I was working on producing Green Day's American Idiot on Broadway. It was the exact same refrain with a different demographic. Fans of Green Day don't come to Broadway. People who are into punk rock don't come to Broadway. People who are into mainstream pop don't come to Broadway. You know, and I thought the same thing. I was like, well, that's crazy. Like, maybe they're not coming, but you give them something that they want to see. You make sure they know it's out there. You make the ticket prices affordable to what they, you know, what they're used to or what their discretionary income will allow, and they'll come. You know, I could continue, but like every single one of my shows, I face that same kind of refrain, you know, because I like to do work that pushes the boundaries a little bit. I like to think that that's a touchstone of my projects, is that the projects I work on are not obvious and they do push the boundaries a little bit. But as a result, you know, a lot of people that I trust and respect are constantly telling me, you know, maybe you shouldn't do that. Maybe that can't be done, or maybe you can't do that. And that just circles back to my historical mentor who taught me that no dream is too impossible and no person too unlikely to realize that dream.
I was just going to say, I can see the question mark in your head. What would Brian Epstein do?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So I wonder if we could go back to the theater analogy for one more minute. And if I could ask you, how do communities that work well, how do they support great achievement?
I mean, you know, communities that work well, I think are like, you know, to use the common expression, a well-oiled machine. You know, there are lots of different parts that are you know, making up a sum that's greater than the whole. And they're really just complementing each other and there for each other. I mean, I don't know that I have a more intricate answer than that. You know, a good theater production, you know, the director is getting feedback from the choreographer and the choreographer is drawing feedback from not just his dancer, his or her dancers, but from the lighting designer and how the dance reflects off of the lighting cues. And, And you know, the costume designer is working with the choreographer to design costumes that flow wonderfully with the dance. I mean, you know, everybody is sort of supporting each other, not just because it's the right and kind thing to do, but because it makes their own work better and will eventually make the, as I said, the sum greater, you know, the what's the expression, the whole greater than the sum of the parts, you know?
Exactly, exactly. So Vivek, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your work and what you're doing now and how it may tie into some of the themes that we've discussed.
My work.
Like what are you up to now? What do we have to look forward to from Vivek Tiwari in the near future?
Yeah, so you know the two main projects that I'm working on right now are adapting The Fifth Beatle. You know, The Fifth Beatle has been you know I've heard on this interview, you know, that I've been studying the life of Brian Epstein, my historical mentor, since 1991, since I was at business school at Wharton. And about 10 years ago, I decided that I wanted to do something with all this information that I've accumulated about Brian. I've found his story incredibly inspiring to me in every aspect of my life, professional and personal. And nobody had told the Brian Epstein story, so I thought it was about time. And if somebody else hadn't done it, well, why not me? You know, the Brian Epstein story certainly showed me that, you know, anybody can achieve anything if they put their mind to it. So I said, I'm going to tell the story. And I set about, you know, deciding to tell the Brian Epstein story. I called it The Fifth Beatle, which is something that Paul McCartney said. If anyone was the fifth Beatle, it was Brian. And I decided that I was going to make a graphic novel and a film. So I did actually set about doing both at the same time. The graphic novel just moved a lot quicker and took on a life of its own. And as you said at the, you know, I won't repeat my bio for you. You did that so graciously and complimentary at the beginning of our chat. But the graphic novel came out and did extremely well. And now we're very focused on getting the film off the ground. So that's what I am very knee deep in working on right now. And film, you know, not unlike a theatrical project, is also a very collaborative experience. You know, we are getting offers for The Fifth Beatle at both film and television, and both approaches are very collaborative. They're slightly different. Film tends to be a little bit more director driven, and television tends to be a little bit more writer driven. Although that's a general comment that has truth to it, but is not entirely accurate. There are obviously directors that are incredibly important in television and writers that are incredibly important in film. And when it works best is when your director and your writer are sort of collaborating and firing on all cylinders together. But the point is that even both directions, while they may start at a different place, both film and TV are incredibly collaborative media. And so, you know, my coming out of a collaborative place from theater is serving me in very good stead there. But that's really where I'm focusing a lot of my energies for 2016. But I love theater, and I'm also very very knee-deep in theatrical work. I'm working with Alanis Morissette to adapt her masterpiece album Jagged Little Pill for the stage. I'm working with Tom Kitt on that. Tom is the genius orchestrator and arranger who worked with me on American Idiot. But he's perhaps best known for having won both the Pulitzer and two Tonys for composing Next to Normal. So he's an amazing talent. And Alanis Morissette, obviously her place in music history speaks for itself. And so I'm, you know, collaborating very closely with Tom and Alanis to bring Jagged Little Pill to the stage. And again, that's a project with a lot of collaborators, and we are literally in the process of putting our company together. Arvin David is my producing partner on that, and over the next several months, we'll be announcing director and the rest of the creative team and sort of how that's going to roll itself out. And we're putting a like a little family together of creatives who will support each other's efforts and help us along the way. It's certainly not the most intuitive project to bring to stage. But I think everybody who I mention it to understands how, you know, challenges aside, it could be something that could be really special and perhaps even genre pushing. And so very excited about that. And I would say those are my two main projects that I'm pursuing this year. And both, you know, both are pushing the envelope a little bit, and both will require my asking for a lot of help from a lot of different people, historical and real life mentors. And will require the team of people that are working intimately on it to be there for each other and to know when to lean on each other and when to ask for help and when to give help.
That's great. Very exciting, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes next. Vivek, how can listeners learn more about you?
Well, thank you for asking. You can get an overview on all of my projects at my company website. Tiwari Entertainment Group is the name of the company, and our website is tiwarient.com. That's T-I-W-A-R-Y-E-N-T, like entertainment.com. We're also on Twitter at @tiwarient. I am also personally on both Twitter and Facebook. I am Vivek J. Tiwari. That's V-I-V-E-K-J-T-I-W-A-R-Y. And that's my Twitter handle, at Vivek J. Tiwari. And that is that's also how you can find me on Facebook. Similarly, The Fifth Beatle is online at fifthbeatle.com. We're on Facebook at The Fifth Beatle. And we're on Twitter at Fifth Beatle. So please like us, follow us. Or keep in touch with us on our website. And there's going to be a lot of exciting news coming on both projects in the next handful of months. The Fifth Beatle, we should be announcing our director and our creative team, and ditto for the Jagged Little Pill stage project.
And I can tell listeners that you will gain a lot of value by following Vivek. He's a real superstar. So Vivek, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. It's been a really exciting discussion about success, about the trials and tribulations of figuring out your path and pursuing it. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh my gosh, I love coming on the show. It's my second time joining you, and I would be happy to come back anytime. Anything I'm doing could be useful to your listeners. So it's really my pleasure.
Thank you, Vivek. My guest today has been Vivek Tiwari, author, producer, and founder of Tiwari Entertainment Group. Thank you again, Vivek, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by Tend Strategic Partners. I hope you enjoyed our discussion. What has your experience been getting help when you've hit a plateau? What would you like to learn through this podcast that would give you the support you need? Would you like to connect with any of our guests to learn more? Let's continue the discussion. Connect with me on LinkedIn and Twitter, or leave me a message on my personal phone number, 646-216-9306. I really would like to hear from you. If you like what you've heard today, please share this episode with your colleagues and friends. And it would help a great deal if you would write a review on iTunes so that new people can find us. Come back and listen next week as we talk about how you can turn your personal belief into reality. My guest, Teresa Fetti, who created 10x growth in her company and was recognized by Fortune magazine as one of its most powerful women entrepreneurs, shares some great insights that you won't want to miss. I hope you've enjoyed what you've learned. I know your time is precious, and I want to thank you for spending some of it with us today.